The music will kindly cease, says Speaker Martin, rather hopefully. But, of course, when he said the convention would come to order, you heard that yell that greeted his words, almost a defiant yell. Somewhere down in that mass of people slowly moving up one aisle and down another is NBC's W.W. Chaplin with a portable shortwave transmitter. Of course, we want to hear Mr. Hoover's speech when the convention comes to order, but you hear the yell that goes through the hall every time he says the convention will please come to order. So let's see what it's like down there in that mass of people on the floor. Wherever you are, W.W. Chaplin, please come in and talk to us.
I'm right in the middle of it, Bob, and it certainly is turmoil down here. Practically, there goes the New York banner up now. That's joining in the general scramble. And the whole floor now, the only banners that I see that aren't up yet are Maine. Delaware's only about half up, Maryland a little, but almost all of them are up now. They're parading around. Mr. Hoover's standing up on the platform. Speaker Martin is with him, and he just apparently has given up hope of getting any immediate order out of this wild enthusiasm. I'm sure you can hear all that shouting. The banners now are circling the hall all the way around, one after another. Up they come. Massachusetts is jiggling up and down. The crowds are on their feet. They're shouting. It's one of the greatest ovations. There goes New York, bouncing way up and joining right in the main parade. Incidentally, there was a little scuffle here just before all this began, and that had nothing to do with Mr. Hoover. Two of the gentlemen in the Tennessee delegation got into an argument over whether Dewey or Taft was going to get the nomination, and they had to be temporarily ejected just to cool off. That had just cleared itself up when Mr. Hoover came in, and this wild demonstration began, and it's still going full force, and Joe Martin has just, for the time being anyway, given up any attempt to stop it. He's going to let it evidently run its course. Now back to Bob Trout in the booth.
Well, what can he do, Mr. Chaplin? He can't stop it. Every time he says the convention will please come to order, those people just shout louder than ever. They're happy. They're glad to greet Herbert Hoover. We've seen it happen every 4 years now for a number of Republican conventions. When Herbert Hoover comes to the platform to make his speech, and he always addresses the Republican conventions as the nation's only living ex-president, when he comes, these Republican conventions always give him this sort of enthusiastic reception. Remember H.V. Kaltenborn? We've seen it every 4 years for a long time now.
Yes, I remember that back in 1936 in Cleveland, Hoover really could have had the nomination. They were enthusiastic. They cheered for him after he finished his speech for nearly 20 minutes, but he wouldn't come back to the platform. Well, of course, the reason is that this man, who is now receiving this applause, was perhaps the most maligned man in the country when he went out of office. He was spoken of as the man who had brought the country to the verge of ruin. Well, we know better now. We know that it was not Herbert Hoover who was responsible for what happened. It was something that was happening all over the world, and that he had already taken certain steps to remedy conditions. Well, he was neglected, of course, during Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency, and it was Harry Truman who gave him the chance to go abroad to show his great knowledge in the matter of relief. And he's working now as chairman of a committee to revise the working out of our government, to simplify it from its tremendous expansion and growth. And everyone recognizes that Herbert Hoover, a great American, has done magnificent service to his country now for a period of practically 30 years. He said 4 years ago at Chicago, "This is the last time that I expect to speak to this body." Yet here he is again, perhaps as strong in health and stronger than he was 4 years ago. And his personality is such, his history, his background, that he makes a tremendous appeal to his fellow Republicans. And I feel sure that as you listen to his address, you'll sense something of the man's tremendous background, his long experience, his close contact with world and domestic problems over these many years. He is, in truth, the Republican Party's great elder statesman, and they are recognizing him tonight in this demonstration for what he is. Back to Bob Trout.
Yes, Mr. Kaltenborn, I remember Cleveland in 1936. As a matter of fact, there was supposed to be some further business that night after Mr. Hoover finished his address. I think they were going to adopt the platform. Bertrand Snell, the minority leader in the House of Representatives, the chairman of that convention, and the last chairman before Joe Martin, who's been chairman ever since, Bert Snell tried to get order, and he tried and he tried and he tried, and finally everybody had to go home. They never did get the convention back to order, and everybody just had to walk out. When the people walked off the speaker's platform, the delegates could see it was all over too, and they went out. Nobody really ever moved a recess. The demonstration is still going on. It's not the kind of wildly enthusiastic demonstration that we shall see for the man who is selected for the nomination for the presidency of the United States at this 24th Republican convention. It's a good, friendly, enthusiastic reception for this man, Herbert Hoover, 73-year-old Herbert Hoover, standing so straight and tall, towering above Joe Martin there on the speaker's platform. It's a rather a polite parade. There are traffic jams, of course, and congestions. The parade moving slowly now down the side aisle and going back to the back of the hall up the center aisle. And in some places, especially on the other side aisle, there's scarcely any movement at all. The speaker's platform is almost as congested as the floor where the delegates are milling about in that parade. Down the speaker's platform, there's not much motion, but people are standing there, and there is a goodly crowd. Somewhere in it is NBC's Richard C. Harkness. Standing there, I see him now, looking out over the crowd and looking at that demonstration from a different point of view. How does it look down there, Richard Harkness?
Well, from here on the platform, we can see the various distinguished Republicans as they file by right under former President Hoover. The Ohio banner has just gone by. Senator John Bricker was in that parade. Representative George Bender. It strange to see a lot of dignified statesmen from Washington up here parading through the aisles, shouting themselves hoarse, but they're having a lot of fun. This is the first time at the convention that they've had a chance really to blow off steam, and they're taking full advantage of it. Speaker Martin is going through the motions of wrapping his gavel. However, he's not very, very serious about trying to shut off this demonstration for the former president, the grand old man of the Republican Party. In fact, Speaker Martin has now even turned his back on the hall. He's chatting with Mr. Hoover. He's making no effort to quiet this demonstration. It does seem to be dying down, however, somewhat. The hall's hot tonight, and after all, you can take... Oh, there, they're starting up again. All Speaker Martin, the chairman, has to do is to wrap his gavel for order, and they start out, let up another roar. However, most of the banners are now back in line. There are perhaps 20 still in the parade, and it is dying down, and Mr. Hoover will be able to get on with his speech shortly. All right, now back to the NBC booth and Bob Trout.
It's true that there are not so many delegations in the parade. We can see that very well from up here, Dick, as we look out over the floor from the NBC booth, this glass-enclosed booth above the stage. But nevertheless, as you say, every time Joe Martin says, will the convention please come to order, that defiant shout rings out across the hall, even from those delegates who are very obediently in their seats and really waiting for Mr. Hoover to speak. They're not in the parade. They've stopped. They're waiting. But when the speaker says, will the convention come to order? They all shout no. And those few who are still in the parade seem to be very enthusiastic about it. They're twirling their standards. West Virginia there is spinning like a top. California's jigging back and forth and now begins to spin too. Speaker Martin, of course, chairman of this convention, is connected to Meyer Davis' band way up there under the ceiling at the far end of the auditorium. He can talk directly by telephone, but instead of that, he's shouting, stop the music, shouting through the loudspeakers. The convention is coming to order now. I wonder if we have time for a brief word from Clifton Utley with the other shortwave transmitter somewhere on the floor until the speech begins.
All right, Bob, it's pretty quiet right down here, quieting down. There are still a number... Well, it's relatively quiet. Someone said quiet when I said that because he's having trouble understanding anybody speak. That's perfectly true, but most of the delegates hereabouts in the middle of the center of the floor are in their seats now. But no, I take that back. Here comes the California Standard going around for the third time again. They've made two rounds. They go around the back, and then they come around to the side of the front, and now they're coming through again. You know, Bob, one of the interesting things about this, most of these delegates are middle-aged and beyond, and you get these warm smiles for Herbert Hoover for the good old days. They know those days aren't quite coming back in the same way, but still they like them. Here comes Tennessee with a man riding on one of the man's back, and I don't know how he's carrying it. There they go. He's quite, happy. All right, now back to Bob Trout.
Yes, at 10:45, Philadelphia time, the Republican National Convention came to life. And Joe Martin is saying, we see that this demonstration expresses your affection for our distinguished guest. The delegates say, yay, and Speaker Martin continues.
That everybody in America, regardless of his party, feels for ex-President Hoover. One of the world's greatest statesmen, a great humanitarian and a man who's labored tirelessly all through his life, not only for his country, but for the world and for humanity in every land. It is a distinct pleasure for me to introduce to you the Honorable Herbert Hoover, former President of the United States.
And once again, just as if they hadn't been demonstrating for him all these minutes, almost a quarter of an hour, they rise to their feet, cheering, waving paper fans, waving programs, and Mr. Hoover placidly takes that manuscript and starts to insert it in the music rack, and then he thinks better of it, and he's holding it before him right now. He may put it up later. Let's see.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Republican Convention and your guests, I find it truly difficult to express my appreciation for your heartwarming reception. All those who have addressed you in this convention have emphasized the continuing grave crisis which envelops our own country and the world. And this crisis is deeper than some may think. Every important government, including our own, has broken its promises to mankind. But civilization moves forward only on promises that are kept. Thus, faith has been hurt, hope has been diminished, thinking has been corrupted, and fear has been spread all over the world. The problems which confront us, therefore, transcend partisan action. I do not propose to speak in that sense tonight, but I shall detain you only a few moments. And that is with some appraisal of from the passing generation of the responsibilities which you face. For what is done here and what you do here will affect the destiny of our country beyond any estimation of this moment. For you are more than ever before the trustees of a great cause. The cause for which this party was founded, and that was the cause of human liberty. It has been repeated here that liberty has been defeated in a score of nations. They have indeed revived slavery. They have revived mass guilt. They have revived government by hatred and by exile and by torture. Today, the men in the Kremlin hold in their right hands the threat of military aggression against all civilization. And in their left hands, they work to weaken civilization by boring from within. Now, these tyrants have created a situation uniquely new in all human experience. We saved them from Hitler, but they refused to cooperate with us in establishing goodwill and peace upon earth. Today, indeed, a powerful nation, dominated by men without conscience, find it useful to have neither peace nor war. Whether some of us who foresaw that danger and warned of it were right or wrong, whether the terrible errors of American statesmanship that have helped to bring this about were right or wrong, we today are faced with a world situation in which there is little time for regret. The only obstacle to the annihilation of freedom has been the United States of America. Only so long as the United States is free and strong will human liberty survive in this world. It is in our interest, and above all in the interest of liberty throughout the world, that we aid in giving strength and unity to the nations of Western Europe. It is only thus that we can restore a balance of power in the world, able to resist the hordes from the Eurasian steppes who would ruin Western Europe. And we have also a huge burden thrust upon us of increased armament to assure that no hostile force will reach this hemisphere. With all the goodwill in our hearts, our friends abroad should realize that our country must not be exhausted and overstrained by these burdens, or the last hope of the world has been lost. We should only be playing Stalin's game, for his expressed hope lies in our economic collapse, for which his fifth columns are busy planning. Our friends abroad should realize that we are today straining our American economy to the utmost. Warning signals have already clanged in our ears. Relief and defense will soon be costing us over $22 billion a year. Our federal budget threatens to increase to $50 billion unless we delay many plans of internal social and economic improvement. Even our $40 billion of taxes and the export of materials have so drained the savings of our people that the year 1947 did not properly maintain and expand the great tools of production and distribution upon which our standard of living depends. Nor is there any room here for more taxes except by a further cut into the standard of living of those who do the nation's work. Someone will say that we can increase corporation tax. That is easy. But any student of economics knows that in the long run, such a tax will be passed on to the consumer, who are the people who work. That is, provided we want to maintain real wages and great tools of production. And surely any American would seem to have the right to aspire to the income of the United States Senator, less taxes. But if we were to expropriate the entire income of the country above that level, it would be a contribution of only 2.5% to this budget that we're faced with. And there are other warning signs. Our reputed prosperity has begun to walk on two stilts. One is the forced draft of exporting more than our surplus through relief, and the other is the great armament program. We cannot go higher on these stilts, or we'll break a leg getting down. We should have no illusions. We should have no illusions to the devastating four horsemen of the apocalypse modern civilization has added to more. And their names are high taxes and inflation, and they are close by. Therefore, with full compassion for those nations in difficulties, certain matters in aid to them must be recognized on both sides of the world. The first is that our task is solely to aid their reconstruction. We can provide only bare necessities. There is no room for non-essentials, for profligacy or inefficiency. We must not create a perpetual dependence of Europe and Asia upon the United States. We must not soften their preparedness to meet their own dangers. Otherwise, our sacrifices will only undermine their self-reliance and their contribution the contribution they must make themselves towards saving civilization. And we must insist that the reconstruction of Western Europe be as a whole. That must include the restoration of the productivity of Germany, or all Europe will die. We need not forget or condone Nazi guilt, but a free world must not poison its concepts of life by accepting vindictiveness and hatred as its guide. Otherwise, not only will our efforts fail, but the American taxpayer will be bled white supporting an idle and despairing German people. And if we are to carry these burdens of both relief and armament, we must have uninterrupted production and operation of the major tools, the production and distribution amongst all of the participating nations in this planet. We in America must face the fact that no citizen or no group of citizens in this republic can assume the power to endanger not only the health and welfare of our people, but the freedom of the world. We cannot have the economic life of this country halted or paralyzed. Such men have not been elected by the people to have these powers. Representative government must be master in its own house, or it will perish. We fought that battle once with arrogant businessmen. We can no more have economic tyranny if freedom is to live than we can have political tyranny. There are other ways for determining economic justice than making war on the whole people. Nor does this battle for freedom all lie outside our own borders. We also have been infected with the European intermittent fever of creeping totalitarianism. It's been a mingling of the germs from Karl Marx and Mussolini with cheers from the communists. And this collectivism has slowly inserted its tentacles into our labor unions, our universities, our intelligentsia, and our government. Our difficulty lies not so much with the obnoxious communists in our midst as with the fuzzy-minded people who think we can have totalitarian economics in the hands of bureaucracy and at the same time have personal liberty for the people and representative government in the nation. Their confused thinking convinces them that they're liberals. But if they're liberals, they have liberalism without liberty. Nor are they middle roaders, as they claim to be. They are a halfway house to totalitarianism. They should take note that in every one of the countries of Europe where 400 million people are now enslaved by the communists, it has been the totalitarian liberals who provided the ladders upon which the communist pirates have boarded the ship of state. The whole world was steadily moving along this collectivist path until 2 years ago. And then in our congressional election, by their votes both for Republican and Democratic candidates, the American people showed the first turn from collectivism in the whole world. The 300-year-old roots of freedom in the United States showed their resistance to this collectivist blight. And the influence of our rebirth of liberty has now echoed throughout the world. But the battle is not over. You have the incomparable opportunity of once and for all ending this job. Now, the deep soil of these 300-year roots is a spiritual concept that the right of men to freedom is personal to him from his creator and not from the state. That is the point of our departure from all others. This spiritual concept, whatever our faults may be, has gained our people a life not only of material abundance, but of real human dignity. And today the American people have reached a historic stage which has come to few strong nations in their ability to contribute to the moral leadership of the world. Few nations have come upon that task with as few liabilities. In these 30 years of wars, we alone have taken no man's land. We have oppressed no race of man. We have faced all the world in friendship and compassion, with a genuine love and a helpfulness for our fellow men. In war and in peace and in disaster, we have aided those whom we believe to be in the right and to require our help. And at the end of wars, we have aided foe as well as ally, and in every instance, even the children of those who would do us hurt. We have hated war, and we have loved peace. And what other nation has that record? Now, in these concepts of your country, that this party must bear high as a banner of a marching army. From this room, free men and women will cheer free men and women the world over. You can say that the day is not done, that the night has not come, that human liberty lives, and it lives eternally upon this continent. There may be some of you who believe that you have come here only to pass upon a platform to select candidates for president and vice president, but your far greater task is to generate a spirit that will rekindle in every American a love not only for his country, but a devotion to our American civilization. You are here to feed the reviving fires of spiritual fervor which once made the word American a stirring description of a man who lived and died for human liberty, who knew no private interest, no personal ambition, no popular acclaim, no advantage of pride or place which overshadowed his burning love for the freedom of men. Great as your problems are, they are no greater than Americans have met before your time. You are no less able or courageous than they were. And therefore, I repeat that what you say and do here and what you do in this campaign is of transcendent importance. If you produce nothing but improvised platitudes, you will give no hope. If you produce no leadership here, no virile fighter for the right, you will have done nothing of historic significance. If you follow the counsel of those who believe that politics is only a game to be played for personal advantage, you're wasting your time and effort. If in this campaign you calculate what will please this or that little segment of our population and satisfy this or that pressure group or sexual interest, you will be betraying your opportunity and you will be tragically missing the call of these times. If you temporize with collectivism, you will stimulate its growth and make certain the defeat of free men. If, on the other hand, in this campaign, as a mature and inspired political party, you face the truth that we are in a critical battle to safeguard our nation and civilization, which under God have brought us life and liberty, then you will be guided step by step to restore the foundations of faith, of morals, and of right thinking. If you choose your leadership with full recognition that only those can lead who believe in your ideals, who seek not only victory but opportunity to serve in the fight, then you will issue from this hall a clarion call.